This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year marks our 10th anniversary as a daily national program. On this archive edition, we're listening back to some interviews from our first year. Some of our first guests, who were relatively unknown at the time, have gone on to become rich and famous, like Matt Groening. In 1987, his show The Simpsons didn't yet exist. Back then, he was best known for his syndicated cartoon strip, Life in Hell, which he called an amusing little trifle of a comic strip starring assorted, crudely drawn rabbits. In our 1987 interview, he described the cast of characters.
I only draw rabbits and a couple of humanoid figures. My main rabbit characters are Binky. He has very bulgy eyes, sort of a button nose, and extremely prominent teeth. He's based on a guy I went to college with. And then he has an illegitimate son named Bongo. And Binky's estranged girlfriend is named Sheba, who's basically Binky in drag. It's a part of a long tradition in cartooning to do female versions of the male characters just by giving them eyelashes and a bow on top of their heads. I'm thinking, of course, of Minnie Mouse and Daisy Duck. And then I have my two humanoid figures, Akbar and Jeff, who are either brothers or lovers, or perhaps both. And they wear fezes, and they have very big noses, and they have both eyes on the same side of their head. And they're based on a clumsy attempt at drawing Charlie Brown when I was a kid. My friends and I used to try to imitate the Peanut strip. And we could never get Charlie Brown to look anything like Charlie Brown. So it sort of mutated into Akbar and Jeff.
You make it sound like you don't draw very well.
Well, let me put it this way. No, I was the worst drawer of all my friends. But I stuck with it. Yeah, I'm slightly ashamed of my drawing. When I get together in a room full of cartoonists, I'm the one that is standing in the corner with my head hanging down.
When did you start thinking seriously of being a cartoonist?
Well, my father was a cartoonist before I was born. He drew those kinds of cartoons where prospectors are crawling across the desert, dying of thirst, and people are cast away on a desert island, and the bottles float up, and all those kinds of gags. So I think I got something from him. He also gave me a lot of marker pens. But like I said before, I never really could draw much of anything except rabbits, and so I had no idea that I would do this as a career. Fortunately, I went to a really wild college, and that was called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and that had no grades, no required courses, no tests, no fraternities, no sororities, no football team, and no jobs upon graduation. But the best thing about it was that it allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do, and one of the things I did was work on the school paper, and that's where I met another cartoonist, Linda Berry. And she and I cartooned together, and we stuck the cartoons in the paper, and that's basically how I got my start. She was my mentor, and tour mentor, too.
Recently, you started doing animation for the Tracy Ullman Show. How does the animation that you're doing compare to the comics that you do, the cartoons that you do?
With the drawing, it's just me sitting alone at a desk, trying to keep the sweat from dripping off the end of my nose onto the page. And with an animated cartoon, I work with lots and lots of people, and it's definitely a collaborative effort.
How do the characters you've created for that compare to the rabbits that you do in your cartoons?
Well, they have the same bulgy eyes, and they have the same little button cute noses, and they have the same kind of very tragic overbite. But they don't have the big ears, except perhaps the mom, who has a giant bouffant hairdo, and she probably is concealing rabbit ears underneath. Perhaps in the last show I will reveal that she's actually a rabbit. It's a family called the Simpsons. Bart Simpson, Lisa Simpson, Maggie Simpson, and mom and dad. And they're sort of mutant 50s, father's knows best family in hell. It's sort of a running theme in my stuff.
Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, recorded in 1987. I've always liked interviewing character actors, maybe because they're not the glamour guys, they're easier to talk to. I remember enjoying my interview with Ned Beatty 10 years ago. It was 15 years after he made his film debut in Deliverance and several years before he became a TV regular on Homicide.
Your first film role was in the movie Deliverance. Did you have any reservations about making your screen debut in a role where the character is raped by a man?
No. It, as far as I can recall, never occurred to me. As a matter of fact, I was sort of, in a way, shocked by how people reacted to that. I was shocked, as a matter of fact, even when we filmed it, how difficult it was for the crew. There were people who didn't want to do the scene. At that point, my feeling about my work, my craft, my art, if you will, was the fact that I simply served the story. So it wasn't in my lexicon of thinking about acting whether or not I was going to be identified with this character and what happened to him.
You mentioned how surprised you were at the cameraman's horrified reaction to the rape scene in Deliverance. And do you think it's a combination of two things? One, the humiliation of rape, but two, a certain amount of homophobia?
I really think it had to do with how well we did the scene.
Oh, yeah.
That's a terribly egotistical answer. I think we did it well. I think it's a scene that would bother anyone. I don't know. It has anything to do with homophobia at all. I think it has to do with seeing any time we act out violence and we do it anywhere near how it might actually happen, that's frightening. Because what we've seen is we've seen a lot of violence in films and television over the years, which has no reality to it. When you do a scene that does have some reality to it, it can be very, very riveting.
Do you think that people in Hollywood talk about such a thing as a Ned Beatty type?
Oh, I suspect they do. You know, there's that old saw about, who's Ned Beatty, how's it go? Who's Ned Beatty? Get me Ned Beatty. Get me a Ned Beatty type. I suspect I'm at the get me a Ned Beatty type stage, yes.
So what do you think a Ned Beatty type is?
Oh, I don't know. I hope they're thinking in terms of an actor. I've always liked to think that one of the reasons I've been very fortunate is because I have been typecast as an actor rather than as a particular type of character. And I would hope that if they're looking for a Ned Beatty type, they're looking for someone who can do a few different turns, which I think all actors can do. I wish actors had, all of us had more of an opportunity to show different sides of what we can do as performers. But I would hope that's what I suspect a Ned Beatty type is a guy who's, gone past middle age and is overweight, I suspect.
Well, do things like age and weight affect a lot the kind of roles that you're offered? Do you ever feel limited by your physical presence?
No. Yes. I'd be silly to say no. Yes, you do feel that. I must admit, lately I felt so much more limited by the problems of storytelling.
Bad scripts, you mean?
Well, I didn't want to say it exactly.
Too diplomatic.
but no, I mean, I don't know. It's a matter of bad or good. I think we're having real storytelling problems in my business. When there's a lot of misgivings about the value systems and not knowing what it is we want to tell each other stories about, storytelling becomes very difficult.
Did you ever go to drama school?
No, I didn't. I don't know whether it would have done me a great deal of good. I wasn't a very good student ever of anything.
Do you think you have a different acting style from people who you've worked with who are graduates of the Yale School of Drama or who studied the method?
Well, I don't think so. Luckily enough, my university was the theater. And I got to work with actors who worked all kinds of different styles, with directors who worked in all sorts of different ways. I think I picked up on, through reading and through working, picked up on most of the ideas and thoughts about my trade and in those years. What most actors do when they have some experience and have a chance to work around a bit is they pick what works for them. And you get to try out different techniques from time to time. I know sometimes I'll pull something out of the sack that maybe I haven't used in 20 years and dust it off and see if this will work. There's a little trick about music Stanislavski talked about and some other acting teachers talked about it, that music can have such a strong and almost kinetic attachment to our emotional system. Sometimes you can just think of a little phrase of a song, and it'll get a whole thing going inside you. And every once in a while, when I'm having trouble with, you know, getting the right feeling for a scene, I'll look around for that little piece of melody.
Is there a specific song you've used in certain roles?
There's one that always comes to my mind because I got so tickled when it worked for me. And I will tell you what it is, and you can may take from it what you will. But I used to be able to become immediately and violently angry when I would hum a little ditty that we haven't heard so much in recent years called Ain't She Sweet.
Why would that make you angry?
I don't know
why
it works.
It's a pop confection.
Yeah, I don't want to analyze it too deeply, but something about bum, 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 da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-bum-bum, that just turns, I can get every hair on my head standing on end practically by humming that to myself.
I think that's really funny.
Yeah, it is.
I'll always think of you when I hear that song. Ned Beattie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jerry.
This is Fresh Air.
Hosting Fresh Air, I've had the chance to talk with people who made an impact on me when I was a kid, like Frankie Lane. I used to watch Rawhide on TV every Friday night, and I loved the way he sang that theme. I'm sure he didn't think of that as a high point of his career, but I felt compelled to talk about it anyways when I spoke with him in 1987.
My guest is singer Frankie Lane, who's just re-recorded some of the Western themes he made famous, the themes from High Noon, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Rawhide. During the 50s and 60s, Lane had 21 gold records, but a lot of listeners still associate him with his anthems of the West. Eric Kunzel, director of the Cincinnati Pops, immediately thought of Frankie Lane for their recording called Roundup.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait long. I do not know what faith. Okay, correct. Okay, correct. There the outlaw band make their final stand. Okay, correct. Oh, my dearest, keep rolling, rolling, rolling. Though the streams are swollen, keep them doggies rolling raw high. Through rain and wind and weather, a hell band for leather, wishing my gal was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good vittles, love, and kissing are waiting at the end of my ride. Move them out, hit them up, hit them up. Move them out, hit them up, raw hide. Cut them out, ride them in, cut them out, ride them in, raw hide.
When I spoke with Frankie Lane, I asked him how an Italian boy from Chicago wound up singing about gunfights and herding cattle.
In the beginning, I guess you might say that I was wondering what a city boy was doing singing country and western songs and Wild West themes. But apparently, I guess I was like any other kid who watched the cowboys and Indians movies. I was crazy about westerns. And maybe it all harks back to that. I really don't know, but it all seemed to come naturally, and I didn't seem to have any trouble adjusting to that genre of music. And yet I never sounded exactly like a country singer in the sense of a Jim Reeves or any of those guys.
You know, I remember whenever I used to see you on the Ed Sullivan Show, I used to always hope that you'd sing Rawhide. And the times I saw you, you never did. So I guess I wonder if you've ever included that as part of your repertoire and performances.
Well, part of the deal on Rawhide entailed the proviso that I had to record the song first and that it had to be out at least 8 weeks prior to the TV show going on the air, which it was. And I was glad because by the time the TV show did debut, The record was a smash, and it was fighting for the number one spot. In fact, the producers themselves told me later that the theme song, the popularity of the Rawhide record, kept the TV show on the air for about 4 months, and everybody laughs when I tell them that. And then I say the TV show caught on and kept me on the air for 7.5 years, so it turned out to be good for both of us.
Did you enjoy the opportunity of doing a send-up of all of your Western themes when Mel Brooks asked you to do Blazing Saddles, the theme from his Western spoof, Blazing Saddles?
I have to confess, Terry, that I was a complete dummy about that whole situation. I was working Vegas at the time, and I happened to do a Merv Griffin guest shot. Now, I get a call only about 20 minutes after the show went off the air from Mel Brooks, and I thought it was a gag. And I didn't know too much about Mel Brooks at that time. And he said, "I'm Mel Brooks, and I'm producing a picture called Blazing Saddles, and we have a theme song that we would like for you to do." And nobody told me that this picture was a comedy or a takeoff. I did it absolutely dead sure, certain, serious. And then I was stunned when I saw the preview of the movie, and I almost died when I realized that I was part of a big comedy setup. And I got ribbed about it an awful lot, but he said later, he says, "That's why we didn't tell you." He says, "We wanted you to do it dead serious."
He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star. His job to offer battle to bad men near and far. He conquered fear and he conquered hate. He turned dark night into day. He made his blazing saddle a torch to light the way.
Our interview with Frankie Lane was recorded in 1987, our first year as a Daily National program. When Fresh Air began its 10th anniversary year, we decided to celebrate by giving ourselves a gift. We asked a songwriter we love, Dave Frischberg, to write us an anniversary song. Here it is.
Fresh Air hooked up with NPR exactly 10 years ago. So today's the day to toss a bouquet to my favorite radio show. I must write a timely tribute, but what song form shall I choose? Why not just kick back and take a crack at some good old-fashioned 12-bar blues? So here's to you, Fresh Air of the Icing. Like a middle-aged, middle-class Jewish B.B. King. It was 1987 when Fresh Air went coast to coast. Now they're starting year 11 with my favorite talk show host. Yes, I'm a Fresh Air fanatic. Got to have my Terry Gross. She's so crafty and Socratic, no other host comes even close. She can talk to anybody, poet, scientist, or star. Conversation flows because she knows exactly who they are. That's why I'm a Fresh Air fanatic. Got to have my interviews. Terry Gross makes me ecstatic when I hear her murmur, "First the news." Habit. It's much cheaper than cocaine. And when Terry Gross can't make it, they got Marty Moss Cohen. So from a Fresh Air fanatic, happy anniversary number 10. And if you run out of folks to talk to,
Just play the first 10 years again.
Thank you, Dave Frischberg. That closes out our 10th anniversary archive segment. Excuse me while I brace myself for the next 10 years. This is Fresh Air.